I'm Al Weger, and welcome to what I believe is one of the most exciting and dynamic parts of my ministry, and that is helping people with getting in touch with themselves and loving themselves without reservation. There's a story about an old gentleman who had two rambunctious grandchildren, and one summer afternoon, he was in the process of kind of taking care of the kids, and the sun was shining bright and it was warm, and he started leaning back in his chair and started dozing a little bit, and the kids thought that they'd play a prank on Grandpa, so they looked at the table, and there was some Limburger cheese that was well melted, and they started twisting the Limburger cheese into the elder gentleman's beard. And after a while, he started to fidget a little bit, and of course the kids ran and giggled, and he all the way around the room. Finally, he opened a window and heaved in a big breath of air, and he says, "The whole world stinks." Now, where was the problem?
The beard.
Right under his nose. And that's what we're going to talk about this afternoon. The problem of lack of self-esteem is right under our nose. And to correct part of that right now, I want you to get acquainted, and I want you to get acquainted in a very special way. So would you turn to your neighbor, shake that person's hand, give them your name, and say, "I am a wonderful and important person," and then tell that person what you expect to get out of this afternoon. So I'll start by saying, "I'm Al Weger, I'm a wonderful and important person, and I intend to get some information and have fun." But you can introduce yourself to your neighbor, and remember that formula, "I'm a wonderful and important person." Go ahead, 2 minutes. Now I want to find out, what did you experience when you introduced yourself as a wonderful and important person?
I found another wonderful and important person.
Did any of you have any negative feelings or I really shouldn't be doing this? Okay, I suspect then that I'm dealing with a very unique group of people. Because the first time I did it, the message came that, "Uh-oh, that's bragging." And you know what happens when you pat yourself on the back, you're going to break your arm in the process. Okay?
But in this case, we knew, we were both saying it, we knew the idea, you know, behind it, that we were just saying it to make a game out of it.
Yeah.
Well, a joke?
It's no joke and it's no game.
To put you more at ease, though, to have another person interact.
Right. Okay. But most of us have those old tapes about being humble, don't put yourself forward. What's that other one? Children are to be
seen
and not heard. Don't make waves. And for heaven's sakes, don't rock the boat. I'm interested in finding out what you folks want to get out of this hour. What did you come here for?
Self-esteem.
For self-esteem, okay. Anything more specific? Believing in yourself. Okay. Great. Then we're here for the same purpose, and we'll get right along with it. First of all, I'd like to start with some things that we've discovered that self-esteem is not. Self-esteem is not ego. The person who needs to push themselves in order to get in is generally displaying a great lack of self-esteem. Because people with self-esteem don't need to push, they don't need to brag. They are simply responding to who they are. Self-esteem is not the same as self-image. And people say, huh? Yeah. Self-image. And we've been told that you're supposed to have good self-image. What is your self-image? How would you normally introduce yourself to somebody else?
Would you tell me you're a nice and important person?
You wouldn't say that you're a nice important person. How about introducing yourself to me so that I know who you are? You're...
Hello, my name is Ted Lonswater and I'm from Michigan.
You're from Michigan.
I'm going to introduce myself to you, I guess.
Yeah? Usually people include in there what they do. I'm Mary Jones, I'm a housewife, and I'm from Kalamazoo. Did I find out much about Mary Jones? Essentially, I got the same from her as I'm required to give by the Geneva Convention if I'm caught by an enemy. Name, rank, and serial number. And I don't know anything about Mary Jones, except that she's a housewife and from Kalamazoo. Okay. Also, self-esteem is not a self-concept. Based on intellectual evaluation of my strengths and my weaknesses. It isn't a scale. When we talk about self-esteem here, we limit it as to how warm and loving we feel toward who I am. How warm and loving I feel toward me. That's self-esteem. It's an emotion based on our sense of personal worth and our degree of self-acceptance. Based on who we are and how well we accept ourselves. Now, I was in the parish ministry for 12 years. I was at Wilmer State Hospital for 6 years working with chemically dependent people. And I was in private practice for a number of years before a sister of the Order of St. Joseph came into our treatment center and provided me with a packet and said, Al, I'd like you to look this over because I think that it has something to say for what you're doing. And I might add that that was 3 years ago, and since then we've added a whole new facet to what we've been doing, and we describe it as the bottom edge for health, for interpersonal relationships, for getting along and achieving. Because how we feel about ourselves is a very important aspect of how I describe who I am, of how I see who you are, and essentially how I see myself and how I see you is going to determine what's going to happen between us. For instance, if I see myself as not okay and I see you as an expert, I'm going to be in a one-down position, and I'm going to limit what happens between us in hopes that you don't discover how really small I am. If I see myself as okay and you're not okay, then I'll spend my time making sure that you don't get a chance to do me in. Because I don't want anybody inferior eroding my position on the pedestal. If I'm not okay and you're not okay, we're bankrupt. And we can't do anything about it. Emotionally bankrupt. But if I see myself as okay and that you're okay because you are who you are, then we can get together and we can accomplish anything that the two of us decide that we're going to do, considering our limitations. Think of the last time you wanted something and you didn't go after it. Okay? What was it that stopped you?
the fear of not being successful.
And okay. Scare. Another fear is that people won't understand. Another fear is that people won't accept me if I do that. And each time we let fear stop us from accomplishing what we would like to do, it's an indication that we have a lack of self-esteem. I have a sheet here that we can take a look at. The lack of self-esteem is essentially the result of believing lies. And it's lies that make us crazy, and it's the lack of strokes, or the lack of recognition, that keeps us sick. And there are a number of unrealities or lies that seem to sound real reasonable. And I'm going to read some of these. The first one is that I am not in charge of my own life and well-being. I'm at the mercy of the establishment and outside circumstances. How many of you have felt that way? Yeah. I'm trapped. I have neither the authority nor the freedom to do what I want. Felt that way? Three. I must prove my worth and importance by my good behavior and outstanding accomplishments because I must be approved and accepted by others. And I will change my behavior in order to get that approval and acceptance. And now we're getting into the Lutheran syndrome. I am filled with blame and guilt. I really should have tried harder. With the belief that if I'd have tried harder, I would have managed to make it. Felt that one? I'm far from perfect. I have many faults and I'm continually making mistakes. And according to my frame of reference, mistakes are bad. I am too unworthy and guilty to deserve to feel good. I have no right to feel good. I must settle for misfortune and unhappiness. Hit home? My life is futile and meaningless. I think I'll go eat worms. Better yet, I'll let the worms eat me. And it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But it's a setup for feeling bad and staying stuck and being perfectly miserable. Now, how did we get that way? We defer our authority to someone or something else. We fail to respond positively to who we are, usually forgetting about who we are. We limit ourselves to faulty cultural conditioning, lies that have been handed down from generation to generation. The sins of the fathers go on for fourth generations. We're plagued by shoulds, musts, and oughts, and the author of one of my books, Your Erroneous Zones, has suggested that we are the victims of masturbation and shouldidus. And finally, we are plagued with guilt. Guilt that would drive us to homicide, suicide, going crazy, or whatever else you might choose. Yeah. This list of self-esteem statements is kind of an inventory. I'm not particularly interested in selling Barksdale this afternoon, but he has done some neat things and I've benefited from him. One of the things that he's helped with is getting us in touch with places where we have eroded our own self-esteem. And you can take an inventory this afternoon or after dinner and mark it down from 0 to 4 on each of these statements and figure out where you fit. And if for some reason most of us find ourselves in that place when we first become aware of this, we find ourselves under 90, that means that there's room for some improvement. And that improvement is going to be not only for us, but for the people we live with and the people we deal with. Now, how many of you believe that you're not in charge of your life? That outside circumstances and situations are what make you do what you do? Anyone? Yeah, how many haven't said, if it wasn't for the IRS, I'd have been blah, 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 blah. Or if it wasn't for my wife, I'd be doing that. Or if it wasn't for that kid who found drugs, I'd have things in pretty good shape. If it wasn't for, if it wasn't for, if it wasn't for. The first thing that we need to do is to get rid of those lies and decide that I am my own authority and that I have the capacity, and I not only have the capacity, but I use the capacity to do whatever I choose to do. And one of the rules of human behavior is that I will do only what I would rather do than not do. Oh, but that you don't know my circumstances. And I say it again. The rule of human behavior is that I will do only that which I would rather do than not do. Think of the last time that you felt trapped. And how come you did what you did? Remember? You weighed all of the things that you could think of and then decided to do what you did because you would rather do that than suffer the consequences of not doing it. What I would suggest is that there is a great deal of difference between control and being in charge. And whereas a lot of people try to control themselves and their environment and their emotions, that may be an unrealistic goal that is doomed to failure because we just can't do that. Being in charge, on the other hand, is being in charge of my feelings, my thoughts, my actions, and my words. And there is no one, no force, that has any influence on what I feel, what I think, what I do, and what I say. Those are the areas in which I have charge. Now, let's get a metaphor as to the difference of being in control and being in charge. Have you seen someone drive a car while they are in control? Both hands on the steering wheel rigid, arms and legs rigid, neck and back rigid, and if something did happen so that they needed some excess energy, there wasn't any because all of their energy was tied up in controlling that car. Get the picture? Now, see another person who is in charge of the automobile, gently maneuvering the wheel, being fully aware of everything that's going on around them, probably having a neat conversation with the other people in the car, commenting about things as they go by, and getting to the destination completely refreshed, and during this time, having all kinds of energy to meet any emergency that comes up. Okay? Quite different, huh? When is the last time that you were in charge of your teenagers? Remember? Your memory's better than mine. I remember I was doing a workshop in a Lutheran church in Minnesota, and about the fourth session, one of the rednecks there was getting more and more upset, and he said, "Al, do you mean to say that you're a chaplain for Lutheran Social Service and you're not responsible for your three teenagers?" And I felt pinned against the wall. And then I thought about my three teenagers. Joel, who stood 6'4" at the time, Eric, who was eyeballing him, and my 13-year-old, who was just as tall as I was. And I realized there is no way I can control or be responsible for what they feel, think, say, or do. That's their business. The best I can do is to be responsible to them. And that's quite an achievement, to be responsible to somebody else. I can be a model. I can be a sounding board. But I can't control. And what a relief. I don't know if that redneck gentleman got any help that evening, but I went home with the biggest burden off my back that I can ever remember. And I haven't been responsible for anybody since. But I accept full responsibility to anyone who is willing to relate to me. Some questions. Why is it that we do what we do? And again, I refer to Barksdale, who has started a chart that seems to be quite helpful. It certainly isn't the final answer, and it may produce more questions than answers. But what Barksdale suggests is that at any given moment, the best that any of us can do is limited by our awareness. And our awareness is the subtotal of our non-conscious and our conscious materials that we have available for us at a specific moment. In other words, if there's something that needs to be done, for instance, lighting these candles, you will be limited to your awareness at the moment that you are expected to light the candles. And if you don't know how to strike a match or use flint to light a fire, you may find that the task is beyond your ability because you are limited by your awareness at that moment. At another given time, given more information, it may be that you'll be able to light the candles quite nicely with a match or a cigarette lighter or a candle lighter. But that means that your awareness has improved. Okay? What goes into our awareness? Barksdale suggests four items, and I'm going to add at least one more. He says, who you are. And it is at that point that I believe that many of us undermine and sabotage our self-esteem because we haven't taken seriously who we are. When I ask people in my office who you are, many of them shrug their shoulders. And they said, if I knew, I wouldn't be here. And they're absolutely right. I'm going to divert for a few minutes to give you some information as I see it may be helpful. I'll tell a story about a man who came into my office after he had been thrown into the drunk tank many, many times. And finally, after I convinced his wife that she didn't have to resort to divorce or suicide in the situation, but that she could refer this man for treatment, he came into my office and he says, "I'm no damn good." And I said, "Tell me about it." And he says, "Well, I'm just no damn good. That's the problem." And I said, "There must be more to it than that." And he says, "Well, I'm a bastard." And I was asked, "What does that mean?" And he says, "I was born out of wedlock. That's what that means." And I said, "Well, must be more than that to you." And he told me a story. He said that up until he was 35 years of age, he'd felt pretty good about himself. He was raised in a German family. His dad and mom seemed to love each other quite a bit. There were other kids in the family. He was the oldest. And he got married when he was 24, and he had five children, and he was a Sunday school teacher. He farmed during the week and barbered on Saturdays and made a fairly decent living. He had gone out to Mount Hanna for a while, and that worked pretty good. And while he was out in Mount Hanna, his dad died. And as the oldest person in the family, it was his job to be administrator of the estate. And when he went home and looked at the records, guess what? He discovered that his parents actually got married 6 months after he was born. Now, instead of dealing with that rationally, he went back into his memory and he reinforced everything that he had heard about children born outside of wedlock and all of those negative connotations, and he decided that he wasn't any good and he started drinking himself to death. What he did to his family with five kids and wife shouldn't be mentioned. And we talked about it at quite some length. And then I asked him, "Mel, what were your chances of being born?" And he looked at me and he says, "I suppose one in five. There were five kids in that family." I said, "Try again." He says, "I don't know what you're getting at. I'm here. That's important." I says, "Yes, that is important, but what were your chances of being born?" "What were the chances of your mom and dad getting together to conceive a child?" And he says, "Oh my gosh, they weren't even married. Pretty slim." And then I asked, "What were the chances of you being born even after your mom and dad did decide to get together?" He says, "I don't know." And I didn't know either at the time. But we got the slide rule out and did some mathematics and discovered that there was about one chance in 55 trillion that after mom and dad decided to get together, any one of us would have happened. And you know, I don't believe that we just happened. I believe that that's part of the creative act of God, that a specific sperm, which was a waste product or a potential waste product of dad, united with a specific egg, which was a potential waste product of mom, and that life began and cell division began, and that that cell that was starting to divide attached itself to the uterus, and that in 9 months' time, that single cell divided so many times that it became an 8-pound bouncing human being. And what was born there? Just 8 pounds of protoplasm? I don't believe it. I believe it was the soul. And every person who erodes or sabotages their self-esteem is failing to remember that they are a specific individual creation of the Almighty God who is a soul. In addition to that, we have a heredity. My grandparents traced back to Norway, so I guess that's where I put that. Others of you come from other places in the world. But I'm more than a Norwegian also. I didn't just come from the trees. I've got 100 million years of human history in my heredity. And sometimes I forget that and act as if I just happened. Inner knowing? Oh boy, did I stifle that one. Because I was told that I wasn't supposed to look and I really wasn't supposed to understand. Women tend to be told in their growing up that they'd better read between the lines. Otherwise, they're going to get done in. So in our generation, at least, we've got some people with inner knowing and other people that have stifled it. And I would suggest that we all get in touch with intuition. That sense of understanding things that we've never learned and never experienced. It's a real important part of our awareness. And then something else that we've got going for us is whatever experience we've managed to put together since the time we were conceived to the present date. And accept the emphasis on from the time we were conceived, maybe even the conception process, because I believe that there's a whole lot more to our total life experience than just after birth. Now then, your life experience is a very important part of your awareness because it has either limited you or it has given you permission to move beyond that which you already know. Your environment is certainly a factor. Something that Barksdale doesn't talk about and which I want to emphasize this afternoon is that in your life experience, you have something that lots of people don't have. And that is that you have the teachings of the church, you have the Holy Scriptures, and you have in your life experience your experience as being a child of the living God. All very important. Now what the rest of this chart does is merely indicate in graphic form the process that we go through in making a decision and carrying out an activity. We've got values, and a person without values is really an emotional cripple, and they don't have a sense of direction. The values that we've chosen are the result of these top items here, and they may change from time to time as we get new information. One of the values that I have is that love is much more important than hate, and that I have a right to love. I learned that over a long period of time. It wasn't something that I remember as a small child. I have desires and needs. My needs are very few. I need air, water, clothing, shelter. Most of the rest of the things in life is something that I want. And they may be important, but I could get along without them. How I differentiate is that without a need, I am in crisis. I can get along without my wants. It's the dominant need or want that is the one that I act on at any given moment. At 1 o'clock this afternoon, I wasn't the least bit concerned about food because I had just finished a big meal. It's now pushing on to 5, and I've got some concern about it, and it will become a dominant concern in about half an hour. Okay. Now, tension is the anxiety or the stress within my body that gets me in contact with my dominant need. Do you have any idea what would happen if you weren't anxious at all? You'd have no motivation. You wouldn't accomplish anything. All your values and goals would be set aside. And indeed, you would be a vegetable. Anxiety isn't bad. It's how we use it that is important. When I recognize where the stress is coming from, then I make a decision. And this is something that nobody can avoid. To not decide on something is a decision that leads to action or passivity, and passivity is also action. Passivity is the process of making the people around you so uncomfortable that they begin doing for you what you're unwilling to do for yourself. And we see it all the time. Okay? The decision leads to an action, and inevitably, we are going to be responsible for what we decided and what we did. We talk about irresponsible people or irresponsible acts. That's part of the lie system that we bought as a culture. No matter what you do or say, you will pay the price for doing and saying it or for not doing and saying it. And it will become a part of your total life experience. And we've either increased our prevailing awareness by our new actions and new results, or we have further cemented our awareness and limited ourselves. Why is it that some people are so scared that they panic at the least little thing, whereas others are excited and they move with it? Largely because they have used their total life experience to shut down their prevailing awareness. Okay? Any questions about this? Now, what this chart tells me is that there is absolutely nothing that I can do to improve me. Huh? What this chart tells me is that there is nothing that I can do to improve me because from the beginning I have been God's creature. Can I improve my soul? Can anybody improve their soul? No way. God made me that soul. He has protected me and He has preserved me, and He will continue to do that until the day of my death. There is only one thing that I can do as far as this chart is concerned, and that is to improve my awareness. To be aware of everything non-conscious and conscious that affects my life. Any question about that? My hunch is that there's plenty of questions about the statement that there's nothing that I can do to improve me. And I'd like to throw that open for discussion right now.
Dale Carnegie courses.
Yeah, what about the Dale Carnegie courses? You never took one?
No.
Oh, it's deals with some partial truths, and you learn some skills that may enable you to function in a different way that's more acceptable and more provable. And they're not likely to help you really get to love yourself. And the reason is that, what is the reason to take the course? To make friends and
influence
people. Improve your control, huh?
Oh, yeah.
How about that?
Don't you stimulate your awareness? I don't know.
I'm sure that they stimulate the awareness. And we can become very highly technically trained and skilled and still not love ourselves. Because almost always when you build your image, there's always some more that you need to do in order to be a little bit better. And what if you live on praise? If your sustenance is the positive feedback from other people, you've got to continually be doing better in order to get the same amount of praise in the future. And part of the midlife depression that many people go through is the realization that I've done the best I knew how. And I'm no longer physically or mentally able to do what I've done in the past, so therefore I'm no good. And it's interesting that the treatment of choice for middle-aged depression, at least in Minnesota, if you can't afford the psychiatrist at $90 an hour, they'll feed you the little black box and the shock treatments, and it takes the anxiety away, and you soon forget that you had all of those ideals, and you manage at a lower level. Pitiful. But it's one way of relieving the anxiety.
How does the scripture passage fit into this that says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me?
I see that as a part of our total life experience, reinforcing the fact that I am a living soul and I have the love of God from creation. That's a part of reality. And the truth is that with Christ I can do anything within my capabilities. I don't know if I'm ready to climb that mountain yet, but I did manage to get up to Holden Lake, and I feel good about that. Okay, I'm suggesting that there are two commandments in the New Testament that we all know, and we discount them and sabotage them both. When Jesus was asked, what is the great commandment? Remember what he answered? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. How come he added, and yourself? Why didn't he say, just love your neighbor? There's a law that takes place with trust and love. It's impossible to trust anybody else any further than you trust yourself. You know why thieves carry guns? Because they're afraid they're going to get robbed. Makes sense, doesn't it? Can a husband trust his wife any further than he can be trusted? Usually not. He might know better, but he usually puts the same limitations on other people, huh, that he does on himself. Well, it's also true with love. If we don't love ourselves, we're a dry well when it comes to loving other people. When is it that you've felt warmest and closest to someone else? When you were feeling miserable yourself? Or when you were feeling warm and loving toward yourself? Check it out. When have you had your best conversations with your spouse? When you've been real upset with something that you've done or what you haven't done, or when you feel at ease and warm about who you are and what you're doing. Remember what the other commandment in the New Testament is? Judge not, lest ye be judged. What is the formula for feeling miserable? Anyone? Judging others. Putting a high value on something or another person or on an action and then resisting it like a bulldog, not letting it go. Think about the last thing that you were upset about. It could be abortion. It could be shooting down the plane in the North Pacific waters, taxes. I'm betraying my age at this point, but one of my cousins married a Catholic. And boy, you should have seen the whole family riot. Grandma didn't speak to my cousin for years. It was a whole different story, however, when the oldest boy started playing professional football for the Buffalo New York team. That was different. But to set a value on something and then resist it, not doing anything about it, but just hanging on, is the way that we're going to feel bad. You know what incompatibility is? Compatibility is seeing someone and you like what you see and what you see fits your fantasy of what you would like. And so it's oftentimes love at first sight. And can you imagine that I found this person that just fits my values and my ideals? Incompatibility happens when I discover that in addition to the things that I liked are some things that I didn't like or maybe didn't count on. And as a result of not liking it, those additional things, I decide that that other person is no good. And whereas I may attempt over and over again to get them to change so that they fit my positive image of what I expected, it just doesn't work. And if I hang on to those changes or the things that I didn't like, pretty soon I'm going to walk further and further away. And we call it incompatibility. It's the addition of that which we didn't expect. Along those lines, I'll never forget the morning that my wife and I were having coffee, and right in the middle of the conversation, she put down her cup, put both elbows on the table, looked at me square in the face, and says, "Al, you've changed. You're a different man than the one I married." Thank God. I once asked Robert McAfee Brown, he was mentioned in the lecture this morning, this was when he was still a college professor, happened to be at McAllister College at the time, and I was serving there as student chaplain for the Lutheran students. And we had been on a retreat, and I had the privilege of chauffeuring them back to Minneapolis. And I said, Dr. Brown, why is it that I never hear the word sin used on the McAllister College campus? And I'd been there almost 2 years, and I'd never heard any professor or any student use the word sin. And without batting an eye, he said, Al, you don't use words that you don't know what they mean. And as a good teacher, he just left it there. And it left me with a study assignment that was very valuable. And before I used the word sin again, I had to come up with a definition. A definition that would be meaningful to me and hopefully meaningful to somebody else. And the Hebrew definition, or at least one of them, is missing the mark. And that I remembered from confirmation days. But it still didn't really say anything to me. Until I developed a definition for love. Not eros or philios, but agape. And after some moving around, the definition of love that I came up with was love is the attitude of heart in harmony with the will of God that expresses itself in action in the best interest of the other person without regard to what is done in return. It's a little bit clumsy. The concept of agape is very large, and it's a much easier word than my definition. But that definition fit for me, and I've shared it with many others since. What self-esteem did for me was to get me in touch with my uniqueness, my specialness, my place already in the kingdom of God, which is outside of my hands. It is God who first loved me, and therefore I can love. And consequently, I have the right to have the attitude of heart in harmony with the will of God that expresses itself in actions toward me in my best interest, regardless of what I do with it. Be kind to yourself. And remember that sin is the attitude of heart not in harmony with the will of God that expresses itself in selfish actions in many ways. And if you really get me to the wall again, I will freely say that I have yet to love anybody else or myself, and that in all my thoughts, words, and deeds I have sinned, and I wallow in the forgiveness which my total life experience indicates that God continues to provide. And that's why I can feel good, and that's why I can love myself without reservation, because God has taken care of me and you. And really, at this point, I don't know what we're going to do these next 4 days that we're together. But I'm sure of two things. I'm okay, and you're okay, and whatever we decide to do, we'll accomplish, and we'll celebrate it. I'm sorry that I've taken up all the time, but I'm willing to talk any place. And tomorrow night, my wife and I are scheduled to lead a forum entitled Recycling People and Ideas. And anything that came up here, or in the reparenting workshops, or positive imagery workshop, we'll be willing to discuss. And I'm going to make arrangements so that there will be a slideshow tomorrow evening, right after Vespers, that will give some indication as to the kind of work we're doing in our school back in Eagan, Minnesota. Thank you so much for this afternoon.